You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme, I'm joined by two Monocle editors here in London and our bureau chief in New York as we discuss some of the day's bigger news stories. We'll analyse everything from the crisis of the global centre-left and the one-year anniversary of the attacks on Charlie Hebdo in Paris, to parental leave policies in Japan and the curious fashion choices of politicians around the world. All that and more here on Midori House. So welcome one and all to Midori House, and a bit of a different format today. Once a week, starting from today, we're going to replace our usual roster of outside experts with an in-house lineup poached from our editorial floor and our bureau around the world. Today, I'm with Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, our executive producer, Tom Edwards, and our New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker, joins us on the line from Manhattan. Andrew, Tom, and Ed in New York, welcome to you all.
Thank you.
We're going to begin today with Paris, where a man holding a butcher's knife and also wearing what's been called a fake explosive belt was killed outside a police station in the 18th arrondissement. Today also happens to be the one-year anniversary of the attack on the satirical Charlie Hebdo magazine, as well as a Jewish supermarket. Tom Edwards, 1 year ago, in the days that followed Charlie Hebdo, there was this defiant feeling, not just in Paris, but around the world. We all remember the rallies that took place in Paris, with all those world leaders at the front, linking arms, standing up for, weirdly, for press freedom, and for, essentially, for freedom of speech. 1 year on, what do you feel has changed?
Well, I don't know, Steve, to be honest. I mean, what really strikes me is it's very hard to look at the events from 1 year ago, or indeed the events we saw in Paris today, any other way other than through the prism of what happened in Paris later in the year, of course. And I think all those things served, when it comes to looking at the media, to reinforce two things. One, a profound responsibility that the media has in terms of reporting things fairly, but also turning a rigorous eye to, you know, the misdeeds of leadership or whatever it might be around the world. But secondly, also the importance of satire. And I know that sometimes gets lost, particularly in the aftermath of what happened in Paris and the loss of life, the scale of that in later in 2015. But the importance of satire. And I think one of the things that has been reinforced to me over the last 12 months is how important it is to lampoon things that deserve to be lampooned and to retain the courage of convictions. What's encouraged me in the last 12 months is that there hasn't been a profound change. That sense of the value of that satire, of criticism, of open discussion, that's remained despite an understandable pressure to draw back on it because of what happened.
Andrew, do you feel that on the whole, newspapers, magazines, the media have responded in the right way over the past year and haven't felt slightly scared, perhaps understandably, and have actually stuck to their principles?
Well, I think obviously Charlie Hebdo is an exception. What it's doing, it's form of satire, and also where it sits in France. The interesting thing about satire is, from a distance, when you're not in the country, it always looks a bit hard to understand, and some of the targets you don't really understand. So, for some outsiders I know at the time, who they were kind of criticizing Charlie Hebdo for what they thought to be a little bit kind of racist, but I think most French people, when they see it up close, don't feel that. They feel that it is very good at provoking and tweaking the tail of organized religion, mainly of the parties of the right. It comes from a liberal left stance. So I think they have carried on doing what they do in an extraordinary way. They now run the magazine from effectively a bunker, from a secret address. They have, you know, police at the door. So they have continued despite, you know, really terrible odds against them. And it must be daunting for their families to still think of their partners getting up in the morning and going off to work for Charlie Hebdo. So, craziness or braveness, they have continued, and goodwill to them. The newspapers and magazines around them, in a way, they've just had too much to comment on. You know, after the killings at the Bataclan and the year that has unfolded in France, I think that Charlie Hebdo moment is important because it's the beginning of a period of time in which things, you know, not on the ground and not in the way that people go to work every day, but things have changed. We've seen the speech today from the French administration saying there will be 5,000 more, you know, policemen. We will be upping the game, and that is a change forever. That is a change that's not going to go away in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. That is changing the way that the country is policed. The secret services are on a sharper footing than they've ever been. There are changes that have happened in France that are not going to be undone. But in the end, you beat terrorism by going to work and taking your kids to the park and sitting outside cafes, and that is the defiance. And great cities, you know, as we see on the show, the urbanists that we do, you know, we did a piece about how cities, you know, rebound, and Paris has rebounded.
Ed Stocker in New York, obviously a city which has suffered a terrible terrorist attack itself and is now 14 years down the road, further on from Paris. The US has gone through everything that France is going through right now. What do you think France can learn from America's experience over the past decade and a half?
Well, I think actually, I mean, probably France's experience worse in the sense that it took such a battering in 2015. I think the defiance you were talking, or everyone was talking about before, is one thing. I mean, certainly after the Twin Towers attack, New Yorkers were extremely defiant about their way of life and what it meant to be from New York. And I think it seems like Parisians are doing the same. You know, we saw after the November attacks how people were defiantly going out, making sure they were having their coffees at outside tables at cafes. They wouldn't change their way of life, and they were proud of that way of life. And I think that despite all the, you know, the talk, the way the administration is increasing security, Parisians are still continuing to go about their daily lives. And I think they can draw on the example certainly of what happened in New York.
Tom, this issue of, you know, going along with your daily life, I mean, do we? Have we? It's, if you live in a Western city now, every time you get on a train or you walk down the street, there'll be a sign or there'll be a tannoy thing saying, you know, report anything that's suspicious. Who knows what anything suspicious looks like? We've had recently the former chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee here in the UK saying that she's alarmed that people walk around listening to their headphones and looking at their phones, and they should be more aware. Do we want to live in a society where we're sort of more on edge than ever before?
Well, I don't think anyone wants to, and that might be an unwanted consequence. One thing that strikes me as interesting is that There's a wider impact to this, which is political. And I think the comparisons with the US are quite interesting. Post 2001, you saw an impact perhaps very immediately on the US foreign policy direction. But in terms of domestic politics, there wasn't the same kind of backdrop, which certainly you have in Paris at the moment. You only have to look at the performance of the Front National in recent regional elections. There's still this sense that the far right in France is a legitimate political player. And I find it very hard to separate their continuing successes from what we're seeing and from the kind of rhetoric, which is quite incendiary, that they quite deliberately stir up to try and exploit the sorts of events which we're talking about, both in the Charlie Hebdo attacks and then later in the year. And I don't think we saw the same thing in America. That's perhaps a positive lesson that the French and other European cities at the moment could learn.
Ed, if I can just bring you in on this point, do you think that actually there might not have been that reaction post September the 11th, but when you look at the Republican race for the presidency right now in America, and particularly the continued success of Donald Trump, that we are starting to see some of that far-right populism in the US as well?
Well, I think firstly, George W. Bush probably wouldn't have won a second term if 9/11 hadn't happened. So I think it did have an effect. I also think that, yeah, you're right in terms of the Republican Party. I mean, they're definitely drawing on the threat of terrorism. And I guess what's perhaps a little more worrying is the fact that the sort of talk in the US isn't it's not deemed as being on the far right. You know, Donald Trump is a mainstream candidate. He is still commanding the majority of media attention. So unlike in France or other countries who may voice these opinions, they tend to be fringe opinions that are on the extreme or the far right. Whereas in America, what's slightly more concerning is that it's become part of mainstream discourse.
Andrew, we're going to, in a moment, talk about the travails of the centre-left in Europe and beyond. But sticking with this subject for a moment, do you feel that mainstream politicians, whether they're on the centre-left or the centre-right, have really sort of struggled over the last decade or so to find the right language and also the right policies when it comes to, you know, whether that's community cohesion or keeping a nation together?
Well, I think you have to be very careful at the moment because, you know, a narrative that we've been following intensely here at Monocle 24, which is, you know, the refugee crisis. So, for example, here's a narrative which has really very little in many ways to do with terrorism, but these two stories have been interlinked. You know, so I think that's where the problem comes, is when politicians begin to easily muddle up all these things. Of course, you know, we need to check, you know, people coming in with refugee status from Syria. You know, we don't want to be giving passes to people who are ISIS fighters that end up living in our cities. But this is where it gets muddled, is when people on the right or the left begin to, one way or the other, you know, try and kind of mash up all these issues. I think if you stick to the issue of terrorism, I think actually there's been a reasonable amount of agreement by the centrist parties. And I think that they have done a reasonably good voice at not trying to disquiet people. Because in the end, what can you do? You can quickly change your opinions and change your behavior around those, you know, kind of extraneous things like holidays. Okay, you will probably not be booking a holiday to Sharm el-Sheikh. You know that the airport security is rubbish. You don't want to put yourself in that situation. But the fact is, you have to go to work every day. And, you know, I live in a neighborhood in Bloomsbury, which was where many of the people who came out after the attacks of 7/7, when the bus blew up. I walk past that site every single day, that you can see the chip marks on the fascias of the buildings where the bomb went off. You turn the corner, actually, there's a building patched up in the Second World War. People carry on with their lives because they have no choice. And that's a good thing. It's like it pushes you. It's like getting back on the horse. So in those things, I think they've been dealt with well. And I think on the whole, certainly in the UK and even in France, I don't think people have been alarmist about it. It's when you go to the fringes and when people try to mix too many issues together.
Okay, let's move on now. As I mentioned earlier, the centre-left has been going through something of a crisis over the past few years. And here in the UK, that has manifested itself in a relatively new leader for the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, who this week undertook, Tom Edwards, something of an interesting reshuffle of his cabinet, which has left many people wondering whether he has the competency to form a government, and also wondering whether the Labour Party here in the UK has perhaps veered too far to the left to actually win an election.
Well, yeah, and I think there's two problems that Corbyn faces. One is there'll be criticisms which I think are probably justified, and I'm sure most, you know, Labour Party, the rank and file will probably agree, which is that he's not managing the internal politics of Labour very competently at the moment. And I think the fact that some high-profile members of his inner circle, or certainly of that shadow cabinet, left as a result of the changes that he made, it dragged this whole process on. And that doesn't look very good for him in terms of political function. Then there's a second problem, which is this question which you're alluding to, which is, you know, where does the centre-left voice come from at the moment in this country? You know, does Corbyn, as a kind of an old school leftist, drag the whole thing too far to the left? And the Labour Party's responded to heavy election or surprising election defeats in this way, well, several times over the past, 30 odd years. I think the problem that confronts Corbyn and Labour at the moment actually is going to increasingly be a problem on the right and left side of the spectrum. And that is that the identification that the public have with specific political parties is diminishing. It's happening year on year on year. And it was interesting that Andrew just mentioned that idea of bundling issues together and that confuses and frustrates the electorate. People are increasingly prone to back issues. It's issue driven, and it's not about a fundamental identity with one or the other. And I think people feel increasingly that that's not constructive. And so the Labour Party malaise, I think it's probably fair to call it that, is a part of that wider trend.
And I think Europe-wide, many kind of politicians on the left, we've seen in the Spanish elections, you know, some of those traditional leftist parties have not been very successful in kind of turning people around and winning them on side. There are, you know, you can argue that many of the populist parties that we're seeing rise are kind of born of a left feeling. I think the problem for Corbyn is, you know, well, there's so many problems. I think, you know, where to begin? Yeah, he is talking to his party. He's got, you know, he certainly carries Labour Party signed up members. I'm sure they have a great deal of faith in him. This is the problem. It goes back to, you know, 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. They knew that they could have those debates for as long as they liked. They would not get elected. And that is the world they've gone back in. You know, to have 3 days fussing over a minor shuffling around of people and, you know, making all these claims and hinting things were going to happen that didn't happen, a waste of time. And, you know, people are worried about things. You know, the people are worried about their jobs and their security and, you know, being flooded out of their houses, whatever it is. None of that was being debated for 3 days by the Labour Party because they were so caught up with their own kind of woes and worries. And the other thing is, you know, that it is great to have a democratic party where you listen to your supporters and you listen to your voters. But when you get to the point of like kind of crowdsourcing your opinions, it's like, we will let you know when we have spoken to everyone else. There is no leadership going on. So, you know, we will find out in the months to come what they feel about certain things. And meanwhile, people have got lots of things going on in their daily lives. So the incumbent party, the Conservative Party here in the UK, many people are kind of, you know, feel that they've mishandled things since they won a surprising election victory. But they do make quick decisions and they are kind of saying things. And, you know, they are a bit, you know,
And no one's opposing them.
No, exactly. Because you watch them, you know, you watch in Parliament and they're kind of having fun. They're having fun because they know that there is no one in Parliament that's really tripping them up.
Tom, as Andrew suggested there, this is a sort of a Europe-wide issue. When you look in Spain, you had a very unpopular government led by Mariano Rajoy. But when the voters, you know, went to the polling booths, they didn't all swing to the centre-left, the PSOE. You know, many of them went to Podemos, some went to the centre of Ciudadanos. In Greece, you've had Syriza ousting PASOK. Only in Italy, really, have you had a sort of a centre-left party that's done okay. Is this down to personalities? So Matteo Renzi, seen as a good potential leader, or is it also down to the fact that the centre-left has lost its whole reason for being?
Well, I think it's down to personality, but it's also about personnel. It strikes me that possibly there's a role here for good politicians. And, you know, one of the reasons that some of these parties have failed to consolidate on, you know, popular support, which was anticipated to deliver electoral success, is they haven't been able to build maybe coalitions with some of the other disparate parties on the left or right, depending on what the background was. And we're seeing in this country, you know, is Corbyn an accomplished politician? I don't know. One of the objectives one would assume of politics is to gain power to then introduce an agenda and actually get things done. Now, a cynic might say, Corbyn's an idealist. He may have good backing from the rank and file of the Labour Party, but does he have a political agenda in the sense that he understands that his first responsibility, the most fundamental one, is to get into office to try and actually affect some of the changes that he talks about?
Ed, if I can bring you in here, you've essentially got a front row seat to this battle between the left and the centre-left playing out right now within a Democratic Party as they decide whether they're going to go for Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. I mean, it's going to be Hillary, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, I don't think Americans are that prepared for anything. I mean, it's interesting to see Americans aren't really prepared for anything that sways too far from the center ground. If you look at Barack Obama, he's not particularly extreme by European standards in some of the things he's trying to carry out. But a lot of Americans, especially on the right, are up in arms about what he's trying to do. And Hillary is even more so a shift to the center ground. I don't think Americans are prepared for anything that varies too much. The center ground is safe ground in the US. And I think ultimately a candidate will emerge to win the presidency in 2016 from that center ground.
Ed Stocker, Andrew Tuck, Tom Edwards, thank you all very much indeed. We'll be back in a moment.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio, every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
And you're back with Midori House here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield, and still with me in the studio, Tom Edwards and Andrew Tuck, and in our New York bureau, Ed Stocker. Let's turn now to Japan. A 34-year-old MP named Kensuke Miyazaki has become the first politician in the country to take paternity leave. Shinzo Abe, the country's PM, has been on a push to decrease the gender gap in the labour force. Tom, the fact that an MP has actually taken up this paternity leave, something which you've taken...
Indeed.
Good use of over the past few months. Do you think it's given that Japan has had this issue about having not enough women in the workforce, being very, very male dominated, that this seems to be something of a step in the right direction?
I think it is. I think it's important to look at what Kensuke Miyazaki has actually said about this, because he himself has said, I thought by declaring I want to take leave as a lawmaker, I could set an example and cause a bit of a stir. So he quite knowingly engaged with this, you know, as an example. I think he knew it was going to make a fuss, and it's a maybe less about the point of principle than an example of what could be done. Yeah, it fits into Abe's clearly quite deeply held conviction that Japan needs to have more women in senior positions in work, staying in work. It's an extraordinarily high number of women who don't return to the labour force at all once they've had children. And I think, you know, it will be a great help if working fathers share some of the load. It's quite interesting how generous the entitlement is in Japan. New fathers can take as much as 12 months leave and retain as much as 60% of their salary, which I found quite a striking figure.
Are you suggesting we should consider that?
No, it's just, it is interesting. You look at, certainly, I often look to the Northern Europe and to Scandinavians. Mm. They're much more enlightened about this as well, and they tend to have much more generous. Men are actually required to take larger periods of statutory leave, and it's not about sharing with their spouse. They have to take them, otherwise they forfeit the advantages.
Andrew, are you surprised that Shinzo Abe is trying to stir things up quite so much? Because he has this goal to have 30% of women in all companies. There seems to be this drive to change working culture in Japan. Are you surprised it's been as dramatic as Tom's suggesting?
I guess it's reality biting, you know, that Japan looks at its economy and sees it's not doing very well in certain parts. And one of those areas it traditionally did well in, for example, was technology and design. And it's been kind of trumped by so many cases by companies from the US. You know, there is no real equivalent to Silicon Valley in Japan. They must look with envy at some of those things, and they must think, okay, we're losing lots of the very best people from the workforce because, you know, women take up these very traditional roles and stay at home. You know, guys kind of stay at the office all day but kind of burn out. We're too caught in this salaryman culture. How do we bring in a bit more creativity about the workspace? So I'm sure he's been around the world and thought, hold on, there's some things going on that we just are not getting right. So those loosening of the ties and those mixing up of things, they're not just about being nice and trying to, you know, give women more work. In the end, it's thinking, okay, what's happening in the Japanese economy? Why is it so moribund? How do we change it? And in a way, I don't think that's bad. I think, you know, if you get to the right place by just doing things because you think you'll make more money, fair enough. Let's take that route. But the interesting thing is when you think it's only 20 years ago, I remember being in a company where there was, you know, introduction of paternity leave. And I think it was a joke. People laughed at it. It was like the idea that a guy was going to take off more than the day that it involved kind of bring the baby home was seen as peculiar. But, you know, that has changed. That has changed, and people quite rightfully take their paternity leave and they use it well and wisely. But I think that's, you know, it. You need these people, you know, to start being the kind of the adventurous ones who say, okay, I'm going to do it. And then it changes very quickly.
Ed, in the US, you've got this curious situation where you have some companies that are saying to fathers, look, you can take 12 months off, fully paid, that's all fine. And yet you also have a situation where, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's actually no statutory paid maternity leave.
Indeed, it's a strange situation. I mean, for paternity leave, a lot of fathers have an option of taking unpaid leave or take sick days. But, you know, America isn't exactly at the forefront when it comes to these sorts of employment laws. You just have to look at the number of holidays that a typical American workers get allocated to see that it's not something that at the moment is prioritized, and it's not really something that's on the that's part of the political agenda at the moment. You don't see it being raised by politicians, certainly not in this election year either. There's that culture of working hard and all the time. People do respond to emails at weekends all the time as well. You know, there's this real culture of constantly working, and that extends to both maternity and paternity cover.
Just finally, let's turn to the US presidential debate once more. And Marco Rubio has been photographed wearing, I think, what we can only really describe as high-heeled black boots. We're going to have a slightly broader discussion about sartorial choice of politicians.
But here at least it's some kind of gender equality. It's normally women politicians being slagged off for their kind of choice of footwear, but now he's in it.
Well, that's what's actually quite interesting, because there's been...
We should describe the shoe, I think.
Go on, describe the shoe then, Andrew.
Well, it's kind of a black boot, but what's interesting is, yeah, Ted Cruz, communications director, Rick Tyler, he wrote on Twitter, a vote for Mark Rubio is a vote for men's high-heeled booties. So the poor guy... So it's a kind of like... It's a kind of like half cowboy boot, half booty, and you can't quite decide whether he's wearing it because it gives him a bit of an extra inch of height.
It's more than an inch.
It's quite an inch.
Yeah. I could do with them, actually.
We can find
out where he got them from. But anyway,
there's an article which says where he got them from. They're $135. Yeah, we can order you a pair.
It does say that it's had more coverage almost than any other thing going on the whole election. The New York Times is calling it Bootgate. And apparently, on Morning Joe, the shoes were described as shagalicious.
That was just what I was going to say.
Sorry.
Never mind. Ed, as Andrew suggested there, it is often female politicians who are criticised in the media for what they're wearing. What has been interesting so far in this campaign is that the only person who's mentioned Hillary's style so far during the election is Hillary herself. And indeed, it is it's the male candidates who are finding that the boot is on the other foot.
Nice pun there. Indeed, Carly Fiorina and Hillary Clinton aren't really being commented on in terms of their fashion. I think actually, essentially, this is a light story, a bit of entertainment that's much needed in this race at the moment. We're seeing a discourse about threats from, be it from Mexico or China or from ISIS. It's certainly dramatic, but it's kind of lacked a little bit of entertainment or an amusing fact. And I think the media here in the US has seized upon those shiny black boots to provide a much needed lighter note in this presidential race.
Tom Edwards, we obviously every month in the magazine have a style leader. We're beautifully drawn out and usually very wittily written. You've got a couple of suggestions of people we should be considering at some stage.
Well, yeah, I just thought it was interesting. If you're talking about, you know, black shoes that don't work for a presidential or prime ministerial candidate, my favourite recent one was David Cameron, our own prime minister, on holiday, I think in 2012. And he was wearing seemingly his work shoes, black loafers with trousers and no socks, and he got a lot of grief for that, I think quite rightly. I don't know what you think, Andrew. I brought a picture in to aid you. I'd rather go for the Rubio look.
Yeah, bless him. He's tried to go for it. He's obviously seen the cool kids without their socks on. Seen them kind of like cracking out a nice loafer thing. And he's just kind of he looks like some retired gigolo. It's not the most appealing. But I remember here, you know, there was like male politicians used to get told off for kind of like wearing brown suede shoes. Ken Clark, I think, was always in trouble. People used to think he wasn't really a reputable fellow for having a suede shoe. But at least he didn't turn up in a booty.
At least, indeed. There we are. I'm afraid that is all we've got time for on today's edition of Midori House. Thank you very much to Ed Stocker in New York and Tom Edwards and Andrew Tuck here in the studio. Midori House was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Gar Lutz and Eugenie Derez. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. We've got music next. The Monocle Daily is at 2200 and Midori House back at 1800 London time, 1300 in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.